I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
And John, we are back, and I don't know if I've told you this or not, but I've been thinking about starting a party at Worldcon called the Functional Nerds Fans Party, but none of the fans are going to be able to get in.
Oh, starting there. It is good to be back, Patrick. We were away for a few weeks, or I don't know, there might be an episode that pops up before this one. Who knows how it's going to work, but this is us getting together to record for the first time in a few weeks. So I'm glad to be back here. Glad to be talking to you and glad to be talking to Ferret Steinmetz. He has a new book out called The Soul Majestic. It is out through Tor. I have an arc of it, and I'm just going to read some of the people that have blurbs on this. We have Ken Liu, we have Shauna McGuire, we have Sherry Priest, our friend Mer Lafferty, all sorts of cool people up there. I'm going to read Ken Liu's Moving and Clever, Steinmetz Never Ceases to Amaze. So, Ferret, what do you think of that? That must feel good getting some blurbs like that.
I got to say, when I get blurbs from like that from people I'm starstruck by already, it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's
I'm not worthy. I don't know what's going on here. But yeah, this book has gotten the best reviews of my career, which is a little weird because I'm not used to getting reviews.
So. Well, that's it's awesome. And I'm a fan. I read, you had books out. It was like Flex and Flux. And I read those and I really enjoyed those. You had such like a very unique take on magic and kind of creating your own world. And I'm looking forward to getting into this one too. Maybe you can just give our listeners a little taste of what the book's like, and because I think Ferret's a very unique writer, especially within genre, science fiction and fantasy. He's got like a really unique take on things. And so maybe you can let our listeners know a little bit of what the book's about.
Yeah, no, I'm quirky, as they say, which is to say that, you know, I never write the same book twice because I get bored. But in this case, Soul Majestic is basically... there is a bar in my town, which is called the Velvet Tango Room. And the Velvet Tango Room is like the pinnacle of bardom. Like, even if you don't drink, it's super impressive because the drinks are all $20 a piece. It's been written up worldwide. They are basically worshiping at the altar of creating great cocktails. And everything is done by hand. At one point, they bought a $10,000 ice machine because they wanted to have crystal clear cubes that wouldn't melt in your drink before they were ready. Like, their attention to detail is staggering. And at one point I was there and just really loving it. I'm like, well, what if you did that, but in space? And so I sort of thought about like what it would take to do a restaurant, like basically in a space station in the middle of nowhere, where you have this genius cook who has just gone off and created his own world to create beautiful cuisine for people to come and pay thousands of dollars for a singular meal. And at that point, I started writing about a boy, a starving prince, who sort of shows up there and wins a free meal there and how that changes his life. And the theme of The Soul Majestic is really about how one of the repeated things that I say in there is that food is what tells you when you're home. Because we all have our comfort food that just brings us back to our childhood. You can be thousands of miles away in a foreign country, and for me, I'm from New England. I could be in Taiwan, not speaking language, not knowing a darn thing about what's going on, but you give me the smells of fried clams by the seaside, and I know I'm someplace that I can get in.
I feel like I've heard Anthony Bourdain sort of echo those kinds of thoughts sometimes, and he was like a world traveler, and it would always feel like he would say like, well, when I eat this kind of food, it makes me remember this place. And I think it's a real sensory thing with smell and with taste that reminds us of, like you said, home or a particular place or a certain time in our life. And I think it's a powerful thing, and I think it's a really interesting idea for a book. So I would imagine if you're a foodie and you like science fiction and fantasy, this is probably a book that you should check out. That's what I would.
Yeah. And if you like Anthony Bourdain, there's a couple of direct references to his work in there, because Kitchen Confidential still remains one of the greatest books I've ever read. And, you know, I am sad, so sad that he passed on. So
I know Patrick's a big fan of Anthony Bourdain and his shows, at least anyway. And So I know this sounds like a book that is up Patrick's alley, I would imagine. So there you go. Well, it sounds great.
Well, it depends. It depends. Now, like, if I start reading this book, you're not going to suddenly shock me with the the slaughter of a camel that you're about to eat.
Did he do that? I missed
yes.
that show.
Well, he didn't do that. He didn't do it, but he's like, oh, and by the way, you're about to see something. Like, they finally started warning you when people would do it. Like, the locals were like, oh, we're going to give you a delicacy. Slash.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I've seen a couple of ones like that, but I didn't see the camel one.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah, I mean, and that's part of the interesting thing, because not to toot my horn so much, but when I was writing The Soul Majestic, I was trying to hit this weird trifecta, because you have to have three parts, because one, you have to have delicious food, because if it doesn't sound delicious, it's not a good restaurant. You have to have really weird foods, because if it doesn't sound like it's something experimental, it could just be the diner in space.
Right.
And then you have to throw, like, science fiction on that, so he doesn't slaughter a camel, you slaughter, like, you know, a space-spanning octopus or something like that. And throughout the entire book, I was just sort of like, how do I make this sound, like, interesting and someplace you want to eat, but also someplace you'd kind of be like, I don't know if I want to go for the camel today.
Well, you know, I like when you have real food in especially in science fiction, because the I want to say it's a trope at this point, but like it's oh, we're going to eat cubes and we're going to eat rehydrated X, Y, and Z. Like, it has to be what astronauts today kind of have to take with them, you know, and mm-hmm. that's so boring to me. I figure once we are actually space traveling people, we're going to want to take our food with us.
Oh, and absolutely.
It's funny, because in fantasy all the time, it's a stew. Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, we're going to make a stew. It's like an old Western. Oh, we're going to have a big pot of beans and everybody's going to sit around the fire farting. And it just cracks me up. Like, you'll talk to certain people and they just think that that's the way it has to be. And then other people like to put food in there. So I'm glad you're doing that. I wrote a science fiction book and put it through a couple of different critique groups. And I had an actual, like, food court on Mars. Where
oh, yeah.
people had built restaurants and were cooking foods. And so I had my characters, like, eating there instead of at the commissary kind of thing, because, you know, it's better food than what the military is providing them. And the people in the critique groups, they're reading it. They're like, were you hungry when you were writing this? That's the only reason I can think of that you would have, like, Mexican sushi.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, it's because I wanted food, real food.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, have either of you ever read a book called Consider the Fork?
No. I have not. No.
It's a fascinating nonfiction book, and basically what it's about is how food is really created by the environment you live in. Like, if you look at, you know, the traditional English, you know, high fantasy thing of, like, you get, you know, a deer and you're an elk and you roast it for hours,
yeah.
That comes because they live in a lot of woods and chopping down trees is nothing. Whereas if you look at a lot of Asian cultures, they're in a place that, you know, doesn't have a whole lot of trees, and wood is very, you know, a very, not exotic, but I'm trying to think, scarce resource comparatively. You'd rather use it to build a house. So rather than burning it, you create the wok and you cut everything up into very small pieces and you stir fry it.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the things that I get started writing this book is because I'd be fascinating. It's like, once you get into space and you're dealing with space bound restrictions, you're, like you said, you're still going to want to make a great meal. Like, nobody wants to eat food cubes forever. I don't know if anybody's drunk Soylent, but I got to tell you, I went on the Soylent diet for a week just as a test, and it was not fun.
You know, that's one of the things that, I really enjoy. It's a nice little detail in the Expanse novels, and it even carries over to the TV show, I think. But I think James S. A. Corey, Dan and Ty get that right with the food, because there is obviously the limitations of it. But there's a lot of food talk in there, you know, in terms
Belter,
of
Belter kibble.
Yeah, Belter kibble. And,
yeah,
you know,
all the time.
You know, stuff being made from mushrooms and fungus, because those can grow. And, you know, the vat sort of meat protein, but they still try to make, you know, and there's the Martian lasagna, and, like, so it's like a really interesting way of going about it. It's like, yes, the people are still going to eat, like, they got to eat, and they do come from people who ate on Earth, so what would they do with their kind of scarce resources? So that's one of the things I always a nice detail that I enjoy about those books, is that they seem very grounded.
That whole series is amazing. And one of the things they also get in there is the classism that comes with food a lot of the time.
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, you get looked down because you're eating the wrong kind of food. And, you know, that's an aspect which, if, you know, you're any sort of minority in America, you definitely get that a lot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. One of my favorite book series from a long time ago was J.V. Jones had a fantasy series, I think, that started with The Baker's Boy. And there was it was an interesting series. I liked it a lot because it was a fantasy series that also, you know, I guess maybe I'm just obsessed with food, but it had food, like real food. There was a character who was like a spy master or something, and every single one of his scenes, it was him sitting at his desk eating something, right? While the rest of the kingdom was starving and people were trying to find food, but he's always sitting there eating a meal. And the just descriptions of the meal, that just struck me because I hadn't seen that yet in fantasy before.
I mean, fantasy is really weird because you either have people like, I mean, I think George Martin does a lot of the, you know, obsessing over the high meals of fantasy, you know, like everything you can get where you can be a lord and have all that stuff. But I generally tend to be, despite the fact that I've written a book about like, you know, fine Michelin dining, I generally tend to be more interested in like, okay, what were the everyday people eating? Like, right, clearly you can't roast a pig every day if, you know, you have three pigs and you're hoping to live on them through winter. So what is your go-to comfort food?
Right.
What's and there's the next not a lot of research on that. I mean, there is a lot of research on that, but it doesn't bubble up to the mainstream a whole lot.
Yeah. What's the fantasy equivalent now of Lemba bread?
Right. Nails. What's the fantasy equivalent of McDonald's or, you know, ramen? Ramen, I think, would be the more equivalent.
Ramen would be a good one. Well, you know, it's always, I always equate it to Westerns. It's like Westerns, you know, they ate hardtack and beans and this and that. And in fantasy, they're eating, you know, stale bread or hard cheeses that haven't gone green yet or hard bread and black bread. And, you know, it's always these things that are going to keep and not spoil when they're on the road.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why you also had, and it's one of the unsung heroes of both the West and any soldier's camp, you know, the guy or the girl who can take all of that crap and mix it up with something local and turn it into something that you'd actually want to eat.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because at one point I ate, my wife got really mad at me because I was at a military like store and I bought a couple of meals ready to eat. And she's like, why are you going to eat that crap? Everybody knows it's not good. And I'm like, I want to see what it's like if you're on the road. And I got to say, better than you'd think, but not really something you would go to if you had any kind of choice whatsoever.
People I've talked to said that those have come a long way.
I was surprised by how much there was in there, but it was very clearly the aspect of like, we have to make this, you know, put this in a box and make it last for 4 years. So, you know.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Well, before we get on to our next segment, I do want to take a moment to thank everybody who backs us over on Patreon. It's patreon.com/functionalnerds. We really appreciate it. We couldn't do the show without you. And if you enjoy these interviews with cool folks like Ferret, consider becoming one of our backers. You could do $1 a month, whatever works for you. But it really helps us out a lot. So once again, patreon.com/functionalnerds. And now let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
Ferret, why don't you go first?
Sure. I'm picking at the point that we're recording this. It's been out for about a week at this point, but it's a video game called Control. And I am just freaking obsessed with this game. If the pitch that I give is a very narrow pitch, but it resonates with the people. It's X-Files meets House of Leaves. Have you ever read House of Leaves?
I haven't read House of Leaves, actually. So you
don't... Okay, see, that's the thing. If you've read House of Leaves, everybody's like, oh my God. And then, you know, but if not, it, you know, it's better things. But basically, it is about an FBI series called the Department of Control, hence the name. And essentially, they're in charge of going around finding all of these eldritch artifacts, which are created from the thing. So there's like an enchanted fan or an X-ray machine that has just gotten these unearthly powers, and they have to figure out what to do with it. If you're familiar with the SCP Wiki, which is basically a Wikipedia written of like fantastic and horrific acts of science, that's basically what it's cribbing from. But they found like basically a huge building in the middle of New York that nobody notices unless they're specifically looking for it. And it's right in the middle of Manhattan, and it is growing all the time, and they set up shop in there. And they basically go around, and their whole secret job is to go around getting these artifacts so the public never finds out about them. And in the middle of it, it is one of the most fantastic bits of world building I've seen in video games ever, because what really appeals to me is the run-up of just weirdo bureaucracy against the unknown. And so you have all of these notices from people like that you'd stumble across. It's like, okay, for the record, the bathrooms seem to have disappeared. We're working on finding them. We know the building shifted again. We'll let you know as soon as possible. And it's just completely bizarre. And in the middle of that, you are a person who has to go fighting your way through to find your lost brother in the middle of this building, which is continually changing around you. And now, I've just been playing this game nonstop for about a week and a half now.
Here's what's funny. I know the game you're talking about. It popped up in my hey, Patrick, here's your PlayStation 4 update for the week or whatever email that they send out as a recommended pick. But you just did a hell of a better job of explaining the game than the game itself.
How
like,
does
the
it...
description on it, it just said like you were, I want to say it said something along the lines of like, you are the director of a government agency trying to regain control of, and it was something like that. It wasn't a great description, in my opinion.
No, and actually, if they're selling it that way, it's even weird, because the way you become the director of the government is you wander into an abandoned building which has all these flashing lights that says it's under lockdown, warning everybody to get the hell out. Everybody's vanished except one weird-ass janitor who tells you where to go to apply for the assistant janitor job. You get to the director's office, and the director has shot himself because there is an otherworldly gun which can reconfigure itself and whispers in instructions in your ear. So you have to hold it up to your ear like you're a suicide victim. And the only person who, the first person who can take this, it's kind of like Excalibur, automatically gets control of this department. So
yeah, that's not
bizarre.
Explained at all.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's a very, very interesting video game. The gameplay itself's a little repetitive, but I just played through for the story and mainlined it all the way through.
Nice.
Cool.
Well, it sounds much better than the description that I read on the PlayStation thing.
Yeah, I'm surprised they sort of underlined it. And now because I really want this game to get more stories going involved. So it's like, please be successful, please.
Right? Yeah.
Cool. Patrick, what is your pick this week?
Well, I'm going to go with something different. Mindhunter Season 2 is on Netflix.
Oh, we finished that literally 2 days ago.
I liked it. I felt like it was different than the first season in a lot of ways, because now they're trying to actually use what they learned in the field to catch a killer. And they're still at that stage where no one quite trusts them or believes anything that they're saying and still wants to do things the good old fashioned way. I don't know. It was good. I felt like it's not as good as the first season. It's not strong. It's got that sophomore.
Oh, really?
Slump
I thought it was
bit.
Better.
Really? I felt like it dragged on.
That's a valid critique of it. One of the things that I really like about Mindhunter is that it plays so heavily with ambiguity. Like in the first season where, you know, I mean, mild spoiler, but there's a subplot where one of the teachers at one of the characters' schools is tickling kids refuses to stop. And the question is this the sort of behavior that you come in for and try to stop him from? Like, how far are you willing to go for something that's not really boiled over yet? And what I really liked about season two is how they took the ambiguity of that, because in season one, you pretty much knew all the serial killers because they're in jail and they've got a nice cell around them. Yeah. In season two, you have the ambiguity of like, you're talking to this guy, you're putting the pressure on him. Is he really the guy? How far do you want to go to break somebody who might be an innocent versus the pressure of knowing that there's going to be more children dying if you don't do it right?
Right.
And I really resonated with that. I could see how you can get a sophomore slump, but I felt like the frustration was kind of part of the point of season two, if that makes any sense.
It does. And the younger FBI agent, I'm not good.
Holden
with
names. Is his name.
Holden, thank you. Holden Ford. His character just is not going to ever waver from what he thinks it should be. Does that make sense? Like he's like, no, this is how it is. And everybody else is like, well, you know, we have to try all the different possibilities. No, this is what it is. Well, no, you know, don't you think it makes more sense to do it? No, it has to be this. And he just would not waver at all.
Even when he's demonstrably wrong at times.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was interesting. I felt like they needed to do, if you've seen season one, the end of season one is pretty intense. I don't feel like they did enough to address that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah.
They talked about it a little bit and then they kind of moved on and it became a little thread with his character, but they didn't do a whole lot with it. I also felt like they didn't know what to do with Anna Torv in this season.
No, which is a shame because she's an amazing actor. Actually,
she really is. Yeah. Yeah, so a little bit of here and there that had some issues, but I liked it overall. The guy who plays Charles Manson did a phenomenal job, I thought, and I think that's the guy from Justified.
It's the second time he's played Manson this season because he plays Manson in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood from Quentin Tarantino.
I don't want to hear about that. But I believe he's one of the characters that stays throughout Justified. He's one of the brothers from Florida. Is it Gator or something like that was what he was called? Or I can't remember, but I think it's that same actor. And he the guy who eventually in Justified like gets convinced that they've removed his kidneys and he's going to die.
Oh, that guy. Okay,
yeah, and it turns out that he didn't. They didn't actually take. They're like, "Can you pee?" Well, yeah. Well, then they didn't take your kidneys. That guy. Mm-hmm. But he did a phenomenal job, I thought, as Charles Manson. I liked that a lot. So, good points in there throughout. I thought it was it's a good season. I think it just is not as good as season one.
But you know the weird thing that I found about Mindhunter watching it with my wife, which was kind of a weird sort of parallel. To backtrack, when I watched the DC animated universe with her, you know, like all the Justice League cartoons and all of that.
Sure, yeah.
My wife did not know comic books before she married me. So when we're watching those, like somebody would mention John Johns and it'd be like, oh, and she'd like, who's that? You know, and, you know, she didn't know the names. So for her, she was coming upon all this for the first time and it was still very exciting. For me, Mindhunter, I studied a lot of serial killers when I was, you know, a really extreme teenager, man. You know, and so they would mention somebody on screen and be like, oh, and she'd be like, what? And, you know, she's like, he's going to turn out to be the killer, isn't he? I'm like, shut up.
Well, and I'll also throw out there that the whole plot with the son, mm-hmm. I knew his arc from the moment he was adopted in season one. Mm-hmm. Like I knew exactly what was going to happen. So I didn't feel like there was any surprises there.
I was surprised that they were willing to go with it, but yeah, it was a reasonably predictable arc for that.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's interesting because between Anna Torv and the guy who plays the other agent with the kid, I have a feeling that they have a really good idea what they're doing with the serial killers, but they're kind of struggling to figure out what to do with the agent's personal lives.
Yes. Yes. And the new guy that came in, I don't know if you recognized him, he was on Fringe. With Anna Torv.
Oh, okay. All right. No, I didn't recognize him. I'm terrible at recognizing actors from other roles.
he was one of the guys from the future. I forget what they called him. He was the guy that kept coming back to Walter.
Oh, okay.
Is it Sunday? Did they call him Sunday? Something like that. But
I don't know. The only reason
guys.
I remembered Holden is I literally saw it on Friday night. So that's it.
Well, no, the new FBI guy that comes in to kind of run everything. He was one of the guys who were always writing in the books in the weird code. And they were from the future or something in Fringe and or from the alternate. I forget what it was, but they were one of the Watchers.
Yeah.
It was that guy.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I was watching him on screen. I'm like, he has a funny shaped head.
Yeah. I was surprised he was still bald. I'm like, well, maybe he just chooses to be bald. I thought he had like shaved for that Fringe show, but no, he's bald. So It's like, oh, okay.
Cool. My pick this week, I've been kind of wavering back and forth between a couple of different things, but I'm going to go with something that would probably be very readily available for people to check out, and that is the Quincy Jones documentary that's on Netflix. Have either of you watched that one?
Which one is it?
It's just called Quincy, I think. It's like a Netflix original documentary. It's recent.
I have not. My wife has said that we have to watch it together because she's a big Quincy Jones fan, but we just haven't sat down to the TV yet. But I'm super stoked to watch it.
Yeah, it was very good. I checked it out because I don't think I've talked about it on the show because we've missed a few weeks this summer, and I got super into yacht rock this summer. Like, if you want, it's
like Jimmy Buffett. Like,
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because I've been listening to this podcast called Beyond Yacht Rock, and it's the guys that did that yacht rock web series from like 10 years ago, and it's these four guys that are writers, like comedy writers in Los Angeles. So they're really funny guys, really sharp. And they did this web series, but sort of by accident, they became connoisseurs of this very specific period of music, which now they sort of coined the term yacht rock. And now everyone calls it that, which is basically 70s soft rock. And they would not consider Jimmy Buffett yacht rock, but they have very tight parameters for what they consider yacht rock, which is like that.
Isn't it?
What's that? I'm sorry.
Like Christopher Cross?
Yes. Christopher Cross would be considered yacht rock. Michael McDonald. I'm basically sort of talking about this podcast now, which would be a totally different thing. But they use this thing called the Yachtsky scale, which is they make up this character called Gene Yachtsky, who, you know, that's how they rank a thing on how high it is on the Yachtsky scale, like how yacht rock it is. And the number one song on the Yachtsky scale is What a Fool Believes by the Doobie Brothers with Michael McDonald singing. So that's sort of the pinnacle of yacht rock. But yes, Christopher Cross, Doobie Brothers, Steely Dan, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, Quincy Jones produced a lot of the albums that would be considered yacht rock. So I was kind of into the yacht rock thing all summer, and I'm like, oh, there's that Quincy Jones doc. Like, let me watch that because I bet there's a little bit about it. And there is a little bit about his time in the late 70s, early 80s when he was producing a lot of these records. The yacht rock guys talk a lot about the session musicians who played on that. So, this one, Patrick and I have talked about the Wrecking Crew documentary, and
which is so brilliant.
Yes, so it's a lot of that. Talk about the session players. So that's sort of a side pick. Check out that Beyond Yacht Rock podcast because they talk all about like the 70s and 80s session players all the time on that. But so there's a bit about that in the Quincy Jones doc. But it was very well done. I believe Rashida Jones, who is one of his daughters, who I think most people know who Rashida Jones is. I think she's in Parks and Rec and lots of other things. Patrick, do you know Rashida Jones? You would have seen her before. I think she's in Parks and Rec. I think she might have been in The Office a little bit. I don't know. I haven't watched all those shows.
Yeah, the minute you say that, I'm like, oh, she's Quincy Jones' daughter? I did not know
that's
that.
Kind of what, yeah,
no, she,
that's like when people say that they mention that the in Blackish, the wife is the daughter of, from the Supremes, Diana Ross.
Okay.
I'm like, oh, okay. That makes sense now.
Well, Rashida Jones has had such a career on her own, and you've seen her a lot that you would never even think that, you know, like, why would you? Because she's kind of known for her own thing. Yeah, it's actually, she is his daughter, with Peggy Lipton, who was an actress in the 70s. She was on the Mod Squad. So that's you know, a little bit of trivia for you. But yeah, he's got like six daughters and a son. And anyway, but it's what's really interesting about it is the career that he has had. He's like 80 something now. He's still alive and still working. But I didn't realize how far back he goes and what he did. So he was a jazz trumpet player and played with all like the big names of the time. And he was an orchestrator and arranger and composer. And he was Frank Sinatra's arranger composer kind of in one of Frank's like big popular periods. So a lot of the big sort of Frank Sinatra hits, all those like big band orchestrations, that's Quincy Jones. And they did a big tour in like Las Vegas residency where it was Count Basie's band, including Count Basie, with Quincy Jones as the orchestrator slash conductor and Frank Sinatra singing. So I did not realize that he went quite that far back and had that big of an impact and that, you know, big of a career that far back. And then it goes through all of that. And then how he got into movie scoring and like throughout like the late 60s and 70s, he, you know, scored tons of movies and then got into production and obviously went on to produce like all the Michael Jackson albums and We Are the World and all that. So if you're a music fan, there's a lot to dig into there, but even there's just like a lot of just the history of entertainment and sort of culture and you know, just sort of social things too, that get, you know, because he was born in like the 30s. So obviously he dealt with extreme racism as a young man and as a young person. So it's a real interesting doc. So I think if you're into any of those things, it's very well done. And I think you would enjoy it. So that is my pick, the Quincy Jones doc on Netflix. So there
he is one of those guys who is just both really well known and yet not well known enough for everything he does. It's incredible.
Yeah, that's why the doc's worth watching, because it's like, oh, you know, he's done a lot of things, but when you start seeing the lists of them, and then it's like, oh, and then he produced movies and he produced The Color Purple and essentially discovered Oprah Winfrey. Like, oh, right, that small thing that has had zero impact on our culture, you know. So it's like, oh, he's really done a lot. And you know what I really like is I take copious notes on the books I read, if they're nonfiction books. And I've talked about that quite a lot. And I've gotten in the habit with documentaries just to sort of have a notebook and a pen there, because depending on the kind of doc you watch, there'll often be these nice pearls of wisdom that'll spill out that, you know, I want to remember. And I took a lot of notes on that doc. Just, you know, he would just sort of spurt out, like, you know, they would just have some interview with him or even just sort of the commentary running throughout the doc, where it would just be this great insight and this great bit of life advice. And I was like copying all this stuff down. So even for that, it's really good. He's still, he just seems like somebody who has thought a lot about how to live your life well and how to be a good person and has a lot of wise things to say. So I think we can all benefit from that. So definitely worth checking out, I think. So there you go. That's my Quincy Jones bit there. So now we had a couple of different things ready to go. And, you know, you guys were talking a little bit about the TV, and Ferret, you had mentioned how there's so much good stuff and how do you decide what's worth your time? And that's something that I always think about, especially lately. I've gotten so, because there's so much good stuff, I've gotten insanely picky about it. Because that's what you said, like, I don't want to sit down and commit to something and then be like, yeah, it was okay. So much so that there are many shows that I have watched over the past however many years that are on like a season 4 or season 5 that I've either just not gotten to yet or maybe we'll never get to. Maybe just like, yeah, that's okay. Like, I don't know. Like, I haven't gotten back into all the DC CW shows this past season. You know, I usually wait till they all show up on Netflix, and they've been on Netflix for months now and have not gotten around to it yet. May not. I watched that show, The 100. That's another CW show. I'm 2 seasons behind on that. And I remember enjoying it too. So I don't know.
But that's the thing that's going on, because if you look at it, we are in such a nerd renaissance at this point that literally 10 years ago, the DC, you know, CW stuff would have been like the number one thing on your agenda because there was nothing else out there like that.
Right.
And now these days there's so much out there. It's like, if it's not top tier or if it's not completely catered to your interest, you just don't have the time to watch to it because it would be a full-time job.
I think that's a great way of putting it, that top tier and cater to your interest. Because if it's something that just hits you right, like in everything in your world, you'll watch it even if it's maybe not top tier. But yeah, it's there's so much that it's like, I don't know, like those are long seasons and, you know, last season was okay. And, you know, maybe I'll just wait on that. And then the next thing you know, you're 2 or 3 seasons behind. You're like, well, I guess I'm just not watching that. Or maybe I will get to it at some point. But yeah, so what do you, how do you go about deciding what to spend your time watching? Fair.
It's weird because some of it is just Twitter frenzy. You know, if I see a bunch of people going off about it and genuinely enthusiastic about it, then I'll be like, okay, fine, I'll give it a shot. But a lot of it really selfishly kind of comes down to how much of it is there out there. Because I was saying before that I was dating someone who was seriously angry with me because I was not watching Supernatural with them, you know, the season as it came out. And I was like, I've never watched Supernatural before, and it's 13 seasons. I cannot catch up with you. And at this point, you know, you were talking about The Expanse earlier, and I've read the books, you know, and they're great. But at this point, I would love to watch the TV show, but it's 4 seasons, I think, at this point. And I just don't have time. So really, at this point, I am waiting for seasons. And if you miss that thing and suddenly I have to catch up for a season and a half, it's kind of like, I'm like, ah, that's too much time.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing. With The Expanse, it's more like a season and a half if you compare it to Supernatural. Because there's shorter seasons. Mm-hmm. There's shorter seasons. There's only 3.
Okay.
4 is coming.
Okay, I knew it got renewed, so I wasn't sure if it was 4 or 5.
4 is coming soon on Prime, but they're shorter seasons, so it's not like you have to sit through 22 episodes to catch up.
Mm-hmm. But there's also another factor which is interesting, because there are shows I can watch in the background while I'm dorking around and chatting with my friends and doing all that stuff, and then there are shows I have to specifically watch because they have so much going on up front that if I miss something, I'm going to be at sea for the rest of the episode. And there's a distinct difference between Supernatural, which is, you could definitely put that on in the background because it's, you know, it's, and there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, it's just a show where it'll catch you up on a lot of stuff. And then there's shows like Downton Abbey or Game of Thrones or something like that, where a lot of it goes on in the background where you just have to watch how a character reacts. And if that's not there, then, you know, that's a much more intensive watching experience, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, definitely. I don't really ever have, this is the way that I watch, I don't really ever have things on in the background. Like, I'm either watching or not watching. So I tend to go for, I guess what you would have described as like the top tier stuff, or like you said, very specifically catered to my interest, because I'm going to sit down, I'm going to watch for a while, and that's what I'm doing in that time. I do like having certain series, and I'll kind of switch up between things, whether it's like a drama. I usually have like a doc going, or sometimes I get out of I'm in a doc role right now, but I'll watch docs kind of if I'm eating a snack in the afternoon. Like it takes me like a week and a half to get through a documentary because I watch them in like 15-minute increments. Mm-hmm. but they're good for that, because you could just get in for 15 minutes, get that much, you know, it's like reading a nonfiction book. And I'll watch some stand-up comics sometimes too. And that's sort of the same thing. That's sort of what I put on if I'm not going to pay attention too much, but still I'll be paying attention a bit. But yeah, it does become increasingly difficult to decide what you want to stick with. And I've been very willing to quit things, which has been good and bad, because then once you get going and decide you want to quit, then I find I get on like a quit roll where I try 3 or 4 things out and watch like 1 or 2 episodes of things, and then just be like, nah, I don't really want to finish that. And then you feel like you just spent a week not really doing anything. It's sort of like your time isn't even that relaxing because you're spending the whole time deciding if you want to continue, which I have decided that I don't like that part of it. So yeah, it's nice, but I do like when I just get into something. I've been rewatching Star Wars Rebels over the past month or so, and that's been nice because I know it's good. I know I like it. There's 4 seasons of it. I'm almost done with the 4th season now. And that's like when I wanted to get into something, I went, boop, I know I like this. Here we go. We'll watch an episode or two and then move on with life.
Yeah, it's weird. Going back to something you said earlier, I find fascinating because it's really, there is a real series of achievement unlocked when you actually get caught up on a show and you can say, okay, I've checked all that off. Because there should be nothing wrong with just watching a bunch of shows and determining whether you're interested in it. But for me, yeah, like saying, oh yeah, I'm caught up on Russian Doll, or I've completely seen like Mindhunter season 2. There's a satisfaction of having checked all those boxes.
Absolutely. And I like that too, which is why I do try to just sort of stick with things and watch them one at a time and get through the seasons or get through a series. I will say this, when Netflix first came around, I hadn't watched a lot of television series in quite a while before that. I just had missed all this stuff. Like I missed Farscape and I missed Stargate and all that kind of stuff. And those were shows that I watched four seasons of, five seasons of, and that's what I was watching. And that was great. I don't know if that's something I would do now to have a series that's got five or six seasons that I heard is great, but it's like, that's a big commitment. And I don't know if I want to wade through six seasons of, I mean, even things that have just are so critically acclaimed, like something like Breaking Bad. That's the example I always use. I never saw it. I know it's great. Everyone says it's amazing. Best show of all time, whatever. It's five seasons. I don't know if I'm going to sit and watch five seasons of that. Maybe I will at some point, but I wonder because there's so much new content that gets put out all the time between Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and a million other places.
Now Disney Plus.
Yes. So there's all that stuff competing for your attention. And like you said, I like the season and I like the shorter seasons because I like to be like, I watched season one of this and I finished it and I check it off. And like, yes, I like that feeling too. It seems less and less likely that one would go back and watch, you know, five plus seasons of a show you've never watched before. That's just where I'm at in my viewing habits. Maybe people five seasons. I don't know.
I know some people do, but I remember about 3 years ago, my wife and I were like, you know, we've never seen Deep Space Nine all the way through. And that's like the only Star Trek that we hadn't seen all the way through that we wanted to. No offense to Voyager fans. It just never caught on with us. But like sitting down and watching seven seasons of a 26 episode season that's 45 minutes long, it was like exercise at some point. And we got into it at some point, but we had to sit down and go, okay, we're going to watch two episodes because if we don't watch two episodes tonight, then we're going to fall behind and it's going to be like summer of 2025 before we get there.
Right.
And
please state the nature of the medical emergency.
Yes. Yeah. And it was a great show and I'm really glad we saw it. Particularly when you get to the later seasons after Gene Roddenberry passed on and they're like, okay, screw it. We're just doing what we want. God bless them. But watching seven seasons was such a Herculean effort of just forcing ourselves to sit down. And yet I hear about people who are like, you know, I was talking with somebody earlier this week who's like, yeah, I heard about Game of Thrones and I figured so I caught up just before the season. I'm like, so how long did you watch? Like, oh, I watched all like eight seasons in 2 months.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, I wouldn't do that.
See, I think it depends on the show a lot of times. So as an example, I don't think you could pay me to rewatch Deep Space Nine. But you could pay me to rewatch Voyager as an example, because I think the thing that always bugged me about Deep Space Nine is that Avery Brooks has no range as an actor. He has very, very calm and he has very, very angry and they are almost exactly the same thing, except he shakes a little bit.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
So it just I had such high hopes for that show, but I felt like everybody else in the cast had to carry him because of that lack of range that he has, versus Voyager, which I felt like they had a lot of strong actors who did a lot of different things in that show, and it was very interesting for me, especially considering, you know, Kate Mulgrew as the captain. I thought she did an excellent job. But then you go to like Enterprise. I can't watch Enterprise. There's no way. I can't. I tried. I'm like, no, this is just the stupidest thing ever. And I also struggle, and I never got through the entire season of Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things where you talked about everybody's raving about it on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I watched the first six episodes because I had to, because I was on a panel talking about it. So I got the free trial from CBS. And at the time, there was only six episodes available. So I watched them. And they were okay. They weren't great. And, you know, I went on my panel and I talked about it. And I never had the desire to go back to CBS All Access and pay to have that to see the rest of the season. But people kept talking about it over and over. Oh my God, it's the best Star Trek ever. It's so Star Trek. It's this, it's that. You know, it's just so wonderful. And I thought, well, maybe it got better after six episodes. So I went ahead and bought it when it came out on Prime and you could just buy the season. And then I didn't have to dick around with stupid CBS All Access.
Mm-hmm.
And I started watching it, and to your point, it felt like exercise. It felt like I'm doing this because I'm a Star Trek fan and I have to be able to say that I watched this show.
Yeah.
I was not enjoying it at all. And I posted on Facebook about that. I'm like, man, I'm really struggling with this show. And someone said, oh my God, it gets so much better. You have to keep going. I said, well, I'm on episode 11. At what point does it get better? And they went, oh.
Yeah, I had the exact same reaction because I said that about The Orville, which is another show that's almost exactly like Discovery in the fact that it gets an overwhelming reaction. It's like, oh, but it gets really good. And I'm like, I literally, like, I'm on episode, like, 11. Like, I'm too in from the season. Does it get better than this? And they're like, and there was just sort of an awkward silence.
There's a couple of guys at work that just absolutely love that show. Mm-hmm. And they're pissed at me because I haven't watched season two.
Right.
They're like, we need to talk about this show. And I said, do we?
But that's the way we exchange things. I mean, like, the whole nerd culture is about, you know, was originally when I was growing up, and admittedly, I'm old as hell at this point, but that's okay. You know, but when I was growing up, you know, speaking Monty Python was like a shared language. And
no, it wasn't.
Well, it wasn't. Oh, yeah. got me. Nice. But
automatically gainsaying is not an argument.
Oh man, okay, I'm gonna be thinking about that all day anyway, but like we all spoke the same culture because there were so few things aimed at our demographic, you know.
Sure, yeah.
That we had to treasure everything we got, and now we are in the era where there is an excess of riches where we all want to speak the same language, and that's why, you know, it's like I said, my partner at the time really wanted me to watch Supernatural so we could have that shared culture. Your friends want you to watch The Orville or Discovery so you can have that shared culture. And to a certain extent, that doesn't exist anymore unless you actually make it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I you know, to kind of maybe cap this, I heard, and I might have brought this up before, but Tom Merritt talked about on his show Cord Killers, and he also has shows about reading science fiction and fantasy books too, that he kind of equates it now that it used to be when there was only a few channels that everybody watched kind of the same things, like you said, Farrah, like had the shared culture and, you know, the last episode of Seinfeld and the last episode of MASH or whatever, all that kind of sort of cultural touch points that have to do with television shows. And he said, you know, now shows are like books because there are no one has an expectation that you're going to read every novel that's out there. Even genre novels, it's overwhelming how many get put out per month. You physically could not read that much in a month. So you pick the things that are most appealing to you. Now, you may pick things because you're in a book club or your friend is, you know, demanding that you read it or something. But for the most part, you kind of pick what interests you most. And I think that's I kind of agree with Tom in that, yeah, that's kind of where we're getting at with shows, where yes, there are examples of like your Game of Thrones where a lot of people watch them and they are a cultural touchstone, but you kind of just do your own thing, I think, at this point almost. So I think that's where it's at. Well,
well, I'll before you finish,
yeah,
John,
yeah,
I'll just throw it out there. Ferret mentioned something that I think needs to be expanded on. There are certain types of shows that I can watch in the background the way he's describing.
Mm-hmm.
Usually those are the more episodic monster of the week kind
yes.
of shows
mm-hmm.
that don't have the overarching, you know, really deep plot.
Right.
So Supernatural actually is one of those because it they usually have some sort of season arc, but you don't. Like you can just have it on and enjoy it, and it's in the background kind of thing. I used to do that with Buffy the Vampire Slayer as well. I would have, even though I'd watched it, I would still, like, if I was doing something, it would almost be like a comfort food.
Sure.
You put Buffy the Vampire Slayer on, you have it in the background. You know, every once in a while Xander says something funny and you laugh and that kind of thing. So I think there are certain shows that are like that, and there are certain shows that aren't. And the ones that aren't, that you actually have to sit down and pay attention to, those are the ones that I really consider, do I want to spend the time
yeah.
on this?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely makes sense because something like, you know, Downton Abbey, where it's not just one plot, it's, you know, basically a whole thread of them, skein of them, if you will, make sure that you, and it makes you more attached to it in a sense of a way. And,
yeah.
you know, at that point, I think that's why Game of Thrones and everything else winds up really getting into your life, because by the time you've actually taken all of the effort to like track what's going on, you want to share that with other people and share your opinions. And that becomes very, very powerful.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Cool. All right. Well, we want to thank Ferret for coming on the show today. Once again, he's got his new book out. That is The Soul Majestic. It's out now, right, Ferret?
It is out right now. You can go purchase it wherever you'd like.
Okay. And is there audiobook too?
Yes, there is an audiobook as well.
Awesome. Okay. Because our listeners like them audiobooks. So we want to make sure that they can get that. So go and pick that up. And we want to thank Ferret for coming on the show. Ferret, do you have any con appearances coming up or anything else you want to tell our listeners about?
No, at this point, I'm going to be a hermit for the rest of the year. So I think I need that right now.
All right. Well, any other projects or things that you have, or pretty much the Soul Majestic, that's what's out and you're working on other stuff now?
By this point, when it's released, we will probably have officially started pre-selling my next book. I'm not sure when it's coming out. It's called Automatic Reload. It's going to come out in 2020. It's basically about what happens when firefighters get to the point where they are automated enough that no bullet ever misses.
Wow. Okay. Sounds good. So Ferret, thanks for coming on the show. For us, once again, if you dig the show, consider becoming one of our backers, patreon.com/functionalnerds. And Patrick, what would you like to leave our listeners with this week?
Well, John, next month is my birthday, and I've decided to throw a massive 3-day party at the Hyatt Regency in the Denver Tech Center. Invitations can be found on milehighcon.org. I know it doesn't say Patrick Hester's birthday, but if you just go there, you sign up, not only do you get to celebrate my birthday with me, but you get to go to a bunch of panels, see a bunch of authors, all that good stuff that you would normally have at a science fiction convention. But I'm telling you, it's totally my birthday weekend. So it's all about me.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds great. Cool. All right, everybody. Well, thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you next time.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.